We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Virginia, and today we have special guest Frank Slootman in the studio. Mr. Slootman is the CEO and chairman of Snowflake, which is valued at over $100 billion. In September of 2020, he led the company through the largest software IPO in history. Mr. Slootman has led three IPOs for three different enterprise software companies, including ServiceNow, DataDomain, and Snowflake. For those of you who aren't software engineers like me or who need a basic Snowflake overview, Snowflake is a data cloud company, a global cloud data platform delivered as a fully managed service that can power a near unlimited number of concurrent workloads. Customers use the Snowflake platform for data warehousing, data lakes, data engineering, data science, data application development, and for securely sharing and consuming shared data. Snowflake has amassed more than 3,000 active customers, including Netflix, NBC Universal, Lionsgate, Dropbox, Lululemon, and many others. Mr. Slootman is from the Netherlands and holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in economics from the Netherlands School of Economics, Erasmus University, Rotterdam. Let's get right into the bottom line. In 1984, you came to America from the Netherlands with $100 in your pocket. In September of 2020, you led Snowflake through the biggest software IPO in history. What advice would you give to students who want to follow in your footsteps and achieve the American dream?
Well, let me start by saying is that you need to want it badly. And everybody goes like, yeah, that goes without saying. Actually, it does not go without saying. Because you know, most people don't know what badly really means. It's an entirely obsessive thing, and obsessive is difficult for for the person, but also for the environment, whether it's family and so on. So you pay a very heavy price for wanting to pursue it. It's just not a walk in the park, right? And a lot of these things that we do are glorified in the press and. You watch CNBC and everybody goes like, oh, this sounds really awesome. I want to do that too. Well, it's not what you see on TV that really represents the reality of it. The people that do this, they have a burning drive. They have a chip on their shoulder in the worst way. They have things to prove to themselves, to their families, to their friends, to the whole world. And it's something that won't let up. So I'm just giving you a little bit of context of, of how dysfunctional the underpinnings of these things really are. And by the way, I love hiring dysfunctional people because they have hard drive and people that are well balanced and do yoga every day. You know, I mean, they just don't have the chip on their shoulder there. They miss that critical, ingredient. I also don't think that most people have the psychological makeup to be a CEO. And the reason is, most people are pleasers and appeasers. CEOs are, they're lone wolves. You have to be, you have to be comfortable in your own skin. If you want to be popular, you'll never be a CEO. I mean, Steve Jobs used to say, if I want to be popular, I'll sell ice cream, the only thing that matters to CEOs is winning. Right? Because, when you win, they can't hurt you. And when you lose, they can't help you. So you might as well only care about that. Well, it's really hard, to act that out on a daily basis because humans, want to be liked and all of that. And unfortunately, that's not the game of being a CEO. The other thing I want to say is, and this is important for people that come from elite schools like you guys do, is you need to learn to think first principles, right? Yeah, I see a lot of MBAs type people that they're so damn smart. They think they have to have an innate reflex to come to the right conclusion. And if anything, they haven't thought hard about problems. And I often back up our conversations in the company to what problem are we trying to solve? Why do we think that is the problem? And the reason is as follows, right? In medicine, doctors spend 95% trying to diagnose you because if I diagnose you correctly, the therapy is straightforward and easy and surefire, right? If I'm wrong about the diagnosis, the therapy will be ineffective. But in business, it's inverted. We jump to conclusions about what the problem is, and then we spend all our time on the therapies, right? And this is the reason why we have so many false starts in business about so many things and things that just don't work. So those are some things, total focus is what you need to have, and not everybody's built for that. And like I said, you're going to have to want it, you know, a whole lot, and you'll get immensely tested. You'll make sacrifices over a long period of time that maybe at the end of your life you go like, I wish I hadn't done that. Trying to scare you a little bit here. So it's, you know, and by the way, not everybody hits it out of the park, right? 99% of people, you know, do not, and that's fine. So it's not like, well, if I just try really hard, it'll happen. Yeah, unfortunately, it's a hell of a lot more complicated than that, you know?
Well, I think it's really evident that you wanted the American dream really badly. And second of all, you are amazing at winning. And a lot of students can learn from that by your example. And I think that a lot of individuals often forget that companies are made to solve problems. So that's really important as well.
Well, let me say one more thing about it, right? I mean, you guys probably look at me like, oh, well, it must be great being him. You know, he's got it all. But you know what? To this day, I still live in terror every single moment of the day, right? And everybody's like, how can a person like you? And that's because, you know, we have this overwhelming sense of mission or fear of failure or fear of letting down our employees or fear of letting down all our stakeholders, investors, customers, and so on, right? Do you really want to live your life in terror? No, you don't. But that's what you sign up for, you know, when you do this sort of thing, right? And not terror in the sense like I'm going to die tomorrow, but terror in the sense of failing, right? And for most people, that is a very, very difficult reality to sort of live with 24/7.
I can only imagine how terrifying it is to have the thought of losing everything that you've built and that you've worked for. And we appreciate your transparency as such a powerful CEO in addressing the realities of that. And so Snowflake is clearly a unicorn startup with a more than $100 billion market valuation. At the early stages of a venture, how would you personally evaluate whether or not a company has the potential to become a unicorn startup, especially without seeing the long-term effects of a business plan?
Yeah, well, business plans are pretty useless. You know, they go out the window when the first shots get fired and then the reality really starts knocking. Here's the number one thing, okay? You need a mind-blowing product. And it's like capturing lightning in a bottle, right? A lot of people build products and then, you know, founders are really articulate and passionate and they can sell it, right? But, you know, you hire somebody on the street corner in Minneapolis, they can't because they're not that articulate and they're not, right? So a product doesn't need 2x differentiation. It needs like 10x, 100x, orders of magnitude, right? Because it's a very noisy market, you know, out there. People don't buy things because they're 20% better. They buy them because they're orders of magnitude better, right? And if you look at Silicon Valley and all the products, you know, I call them zombies, you know, they're the living dead, you know, they're not dead, but I mean, they might as well be dead. It would be easier if nobody bought them because then we could just stick a bullet in them and move on and redeploy the resources. But they live and they keep getting funded and they hope against hope. And the reason is these products, you know, are not viable. And the reason they're not viable is because they don't have enough differentiation. So you have to aim really, really high. In other words, and by the way, the way to know that is, when you present products, and when I say presenting, you know, always show things. Don't tell people, show them, okay? Telling people things is like, I don't know what to do with a story, but I seeing things is a totally different experience, right? It becomes visceral. When people start coming across the table and want to sort of chew off your left arm to get it, when you get that incredibly strong reaction, right? Now you're onto something, okay? Now you have an indication that you're connecting, right, with opportunity, right? If you're really straining yourself trying to explain and show what you have and try to get a rise out of people, you're not there. You need, by the way, you're not even, you know, on the same zip code. And, you know, we used to say, you know, I'm trying to get a fragment of the bullseye, right? If I can just connect with the bullseye at the very fringe of it, then maybe I can iterate my way towards that, what it needs to become. But, you know, most products become wanderers in the desert looking for water, right? And so you want to obsess about your product and you want to get a response from your customer, but they just can't wait to get their hands on that thing, right? So have the bar really, really high as you can possibly imagine it. Then you have a fighting chance. You're already dead if you have a product that you're straining to, you know, promote. So those are really, really important. And products is the essence of it all. If you're in tech, you know, tech is a product business. It's not about business models. It's not about business plans. It's not about unit economics, although these things all matter, okay? They all matter, but it starts with having a compelling product. You can always work on unit economics, right? You can work on operating efficiency. You can work on cash flow. I mean, when a product is screwed up, you know, you got nothing. So that's what I look at, because I can fix a lot of things, but there are certain things I can't, you know.
That's really encouraging to hear. And although it may seem that everything has been technologically created in the 21st century, it's not true at all. You know, Snowflake has completely disrupted the cloud computing industry. So Snowflake competes with the likes of Amazon's Redshift and Google's BigQuery. With such huge players in this space, how has Snowflake attracted the best talent to engineer a cloud computing solution that outperforms in speed, elasticity, and concurrency? And what prevents tech giants like Amazon and Google from developing a similar architecture?
You know, this is another thing that's really important to realize. You know, when you're in school, you're thinking that Microsoft and Amazon are the juggernauts and they're dangerous and they're going to squash everybody. You know, the reality is size is a liability. Okay. You know, where does all the growth come from? Okay. It all comes out of nowhere. It all comes out of left field. It doesn't come from large companies. Where is IBM today? When I was your age, you know, IBM was the gold standard, you know, in the computer industry. That's what we called it back then. You know, where are they today, right? I mean, I actually worked for Burroughs Corporation, you know, back in the mid to late 80s. And, you know, we ended up acquiring a company called Sperry, and together that became Unisys. So why? You know, the CEO said, IBM is big, we're small, we're going to go merge with a much bigger company, and then, you know, we'll be able to compete. Well, he's wrong, okay? Like, the size is not the issue, right? So I love to compete. I've only competed against much larger companies. I just absolutely love it, because they are at a distinct disadvantage against people like us. We will run circles around them, and we will lay waste to them, right? The fear is that there is another Snowflake out there, you know, a bunch of people that just get together in some apartment somewhere and come up with an incredibly compelling idea, because that's history of technology, right? So, you know, how did Microsoft take on IBM, right? IBM was invincible, with Microsoft completely, you know, basically dismembered that company in so many ways. Then Google went after Microsoft, right? Google was also a nobody in the late 90s, right? So that's really, you know, what you worry about, rather than, oh, they're big, they're dangerous. You know, I've run much larger companies, and it gets much harder when companies get bigger, because there's all these layers, and you have many more B players in your company, and the culture becomes more difficult, and all those sort of things. And so this scenario plays out over and over and over again. So size is your, you know, the nimbleness is what you want, you know. So don't think because you're small, you're not powerful. You actually are. You just need to come to that realization. Yeah.
So with that competitive advantage of having a smaller size company, for Snowflake to grow as it has, you've had to convince huge companies to switch to a very fundamental different way that they store and analyze their data. How have you made this transition as simple and cost-effective as possible for companies with petabytes of data?
Yeah, actually, it hasn't been simple. It's been really hard. So here's another important lesson. You know, when you attack markets, don't attack markets where people are happy. When they're happy, they're not going to change. Why would they change? They got enough problems, right? So you go after markets where people are incredibly frustrated and in pain, because that's the incentive to want to make a change. They want to move away from the disastrous situation that they're in. Then they will pay the price in terms of effort and cost and so on to make that change. In our world, we have to do what we call database migrations. You go from one database platform to another. Database migrations in the history of computing have been excruciatingly hard. You know, there's all kinds of technical reasons for it, and they take time and they take money and they're risky and all this kind of stuff. We have made it, you know, tons easier. And the reason is we run a completely vanilla ANSI SQL standard environment. We have no proprietary artifacts, which is, by the way, the likes of Oracle and Teradata, they have all these proprietary artifacts. And they don't map to our platform because we don't have those things, right? So then they have to be redesigned and re-engineered. All of that, you know, takes time and effort to do. But, you know, we face a huge amount of friction in our business. And in spite of that, we're still growing, you know, at an incredible pace, of course. But it's because customers are saying, we have to move sooner rather than later. And so the question doesn't become if, it becomes how and when. You know?
Well, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Yeah, and that's actually a very good point, because you have to embrace the difficulty, because it's difficult for everybody. And you're exactly right. If it was easy, there would be 100 people doing it, and it would commoditize the hell out of it in no time, right? So hard is actually something we embrace rather than be frustrated about.
On the topic of data, and with the rise of AI and machine learning, what unique insights has Snowflake had about serving that market?
Yeah, well, first of all, machine learning and AI have struggled to become a market, you know, in the way we normally think about it, where you have established players, established products, established practices, right? It's more something that programmers do. You know, for example, you know, I mean, we just announced yesterday that we invested in an ML company called Data Robot, which is out in your neck of the woods. And you know, we like them. They're a good partner, and we have a good relationship because they drive consumption on our platform. But we're really scratching our head as to how this market really is developing and how it's going to develop. And, you know, people like Google are basically saying, you know, we have our own products, our own offerings. It's a full-on Google integrated stack, and that's what we offer to our customers. We take a different approach. You know, we are completely open architecture, meaning that, you know, we enable any and all products, any and all approaches, any and all languages. And we envision a marketplace where lots and lots of people are developing standard services. I mean, I'll give you an example, right? For example, let's take a medical image like an MRI or CAT scan or whatever it is, right? I want to be able to pass that off to a service, you know, that is going to evaluate that based on, you know, massive amount of historical data about, you know, have knowledge about these kinds of scans, and then can combine that with clinical data and then provide basically a read back to the radiologist. So by the time the radiologist sees the scan, that thing has already been massively, you know, machine learned. And basically the radiologist now has a much better understanding, you know, based on, you know, having the system having looked at a million other scans as to what the likely diagnosis analysis and what kind of guidance they should give. And some of the bigger healthcare companies out there, you know, like Philips and so on, big medical equipment, MRI companies, that is exactly where they're going with it. But many, many companies should be able to develop these kind of services and be expert at these kind of services. Same thing, you know, facial recognition, for example, you know, somebody captures from a street cam, you know, a photograph. I want to be able to send that, you know, to a service, and somebody tells me, yeah, I've referenced it 99% certain it's this person, blah, 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 blah. So there's going to be a massive industry, you know, in terms of developing these kind of services. And that's really what we want. We want there to be a marketplace, you know, in machine learning and services, because I don't want to develop these things. I just want to use them, right? Because there's not enough talent in the world, you know, for everybody to develop these things on their own, right? We just want to consume them. We don't want, you know, we don't want to understand the intricate details of all these things. It's way too complicated, right?
It's nice to hear that Snowflake has taken an open approach, because developers always appreciate the flexibility it provides. Next, in addition to taking Snowflake public, you also led IPOs for Data Domain and ServiceNow. In your opinion, what is your greatest strength as a CEO?
You know, somebody asked me the other day, they said, what makes a great CEO? And I said, great CEOs have great outcomes. You may think like, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what your strengths are. If you have great outcomes, you know, you're a great CEO. If you don't have great outcomes, you're definitely not a great CEO. You know, everybody has their own thing. I wouldn't say there is just, you know, one way to be, but for me personally, which is a question you're asking, we have a singular focus and hard drive on the business. We're extremely mission centric, mission oriented. Now you're like, well, isn't everybody like that? As a matter of fact, no. I mean, tons of people are using their companies as, you know, social gathering, self-aggrandizement, social justice. I mean, you name it, right? We don't do any of that stuff, okay? And there's only one thing, you know, that we think about 24/7, and that is how to advance our mission, right? Which is to develop the potential, you know, that we have, you know, developed. It's really hard to do because humans are naturally, they dilute their focus, they distract themselves all day long. And it's something that you have to fight. Anything that has daylight between us and the goal that we're pursuing, we are basically, you know, crossing it out. And I look at what people are working on. And if you're not in the drivetrain of the business, you know, why would I be spending time and money on it, right? In other words, you narrow the aperture more and more and more, and then the resources become incredibly powerful and productive, right? So it's the overwhelming drive to succeed at what you do is really what gives you the fighting chance. And the moment you start compromising and diluting that, you're already dead, okay? And this is a very hard lesson to learn for many people. I'll give you an example, right? In almost all my conversation with CEOs of young companies, right, they want to tell me how great the product is. And I'm like, well, if your product is so great, why aren't you growing 3 times as fast then? And then they don't have an answer, right? And then I ask, well, how fast could you grow? They don't have an answer for that. Well, why don't you know that? Are you leaning in all the way? Well, why not, right? In other words, you know, the lack of clarity of thought around these things is what screws people up, right? But that's because they're not really focused, you know, on what needs to happen here. They have a lot of hesitation, they lack conviction, and they're not fully deployed and applied to their mission, right? And all of a sudden, you know, you kind of have a venture that is going sideways, confusing the hell out of the people, because it doesn't have that clarity of focus and drive and deployment of resources. And businesses are very confusing. When you get inside of them, there's a million things going on, and it's very easy to get confused and defocused. And that's the role of CEOs and founders and leaders, is to, you fight it every step of the way. And it requires a certain mindset. I think that most CEOs are not functional thinkers. They're typically not engineers or finance people. They are people that are highly lateral and abstract in their thinking, right? Because they have the overview. And they're constantly reprocessing, you know, and that's very important, because you can get in the weeds very, very fast. And that is what you cannot allow to happen. Okay. It's a good question. Important question.
Following up from that, how do you lead technical teams without getting in the weeds?
Yeah, you know, now we're getting to, you know, much more how does engineering management, you know, focuses. So, you know, in the early days, you know, we're almost purely an innovation-based operation. It's an extremely small team. It is incredibly creative. It's very architecturally pure and all of that. And it's the creative formative stages. It's almost like it's the stem cells, if you will, of what is to become, right? And it has a totally different dynamic to it, culture to it, all these kinds of things. You know, when I joined Snowflake, I mean, the company was just engulfed in creative energy, and they had done incredible things. They were so left field. They had a clean sheet of paper. They burned the ships behind them, and it results in incredible things. But then, you know, the reality sets in, because large enterprises are living and dying by what you have built. And now you need to engage the other side, and the other side is scale, hardening, maturing, you know, security, the resiliency of the platform, because now people can't tolerate, you know, less than 4 nines availability. Well, it's really hard to build those levels of resiliency into a platform that is just relentless high-scale engineering. So we actually, hired leadership actually out of Google. You know, that because Google obviously is a very highly scaled environment, you know, to help us, you know, develop that other side of the muscle. So what you really want is this combination of creative energy as well as massive discipline at scale. You need both. Otherwise, you just, you know, you cannot fulfill your promise if you don't have both. Because we're still a very creative enterprise, right? Where we are, we have numerous threats executing in terms of creating, you know, brand new things. But at the same time, you know, I now have thousands and thousands of customers. We're processing almost whatever it is, 750 million queries a day. A day, okay? These are insane numbers. So, and it's growing, by the way, more than 100% a year. So you can just imagine that we'll be up to billions of queries a day before long. That's pretty daunting, you know?
It's amazing to see Snowflake's rapid growth over time. Next, I'll pass it on to Jess, our expert bioengineer at Harvard.
Amazing. So we talked about kind of how impactful having a good product was in how you sell your vision. But I think another important component of building a company is the timing, making sure the timing is right with the market. So can you speak to how timing has attributed to the success of Snowflake? And then I think a follow-on to that, it may be hard to talk about timing without also talking about COVID-19 and how that has impacted the growth of the company.
Yeah, you know, I'll talk about COVID. First, I kind of ignored COVID. Okay, I was pretending like it wasn't happening because, and I'm not being flippant when I say that. It's just I don't want to. People were freaking out. They were getting anxious, and all of a sudden, everybody has excuses why they can't do this and they can't do that, and we can't get to our numbers anymore, and blah blah. I'm like, forget all that. We're gonna do exactly what we're gonna do. COVID or no COVID, we're not going to get some goddamn pandemic, you know, interfere with our plans. Okay. That's leadership, by the way, right? So everybody back to work, let's normalize what we're doing day to day, you know, and stop the freak out. And, you know, and normalization is really important. The way you do that is to really have standard institutions that we can fall back on, whether we're in the office or we're not in the office, meaning standard check-ins, standard meetings, standard events, standard processes. After a while, people forget, you know, there is a pandemic going on because we're just engrossed in doing the work. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, we are continuing to on a tear completely. I mean, we have not really been impacted by COVID for a number of reasons, because there's pluses and minuses to COVID. Some industries are affected, which then affects demand sentiment, which then affects our business. But other businesses are accelerating data analytics, data platforms, because COVID has basically thrown people for a loop, right? You saw governments had no data. They were basically, you know, staring at the ceiling, like, what the hell is happening? What are we supposed to be doing? They were pretty much wrong like the first 15 times because they have no data. And the same is true with enterprises. And all of a sudden, they don't know where demand is, where demand isn't. And they can't provision themselves anymore. I mean, all these, when you get dislocated, data becomes really, really important. When you're running a business as usual day to day, you can rely much more on anecdotal observation, meaning, you know, talking to people, you know, consuming the news feed, all the stuff that humans do. When you get dislocated, all of a sudden it's total freak out. Now you need data, right? And that's really what we've learned here, and that has positively affected our business. But the concept of timing in general, you know, it's kind of hard to know, you know, whether one timing or another would be better than another. In the case of Snowflake, you know, we've had cloud scale computing, you know, I want to really say since the mid 2000s, you know, when Amazon really started to bring Amazon Web Services out and so on. But, you know, for the first, you know, whatever, 5-10 years, everything that was in the cloud really was not cloud native. They were basically cloud hosted. So they were on-premise software that was hosted in the cloud. That doesn't make it cloud native at all. It's just hosted in the cloud. And by the way, most cloud companies that you know of, you know, are of that sort. There's really nothing cloud native about them. And it doesn't make it bad. It just means that it takes time, you know, for certain levels of innovation to really come to those platforms. And Snowflake was really the first product I saw that was completely designed and sort of reimagined, if you will, for cloud scale. It wasn't going to run on premise. It wasn't going to run in a private cloud. It was only going to run in the public cloud. And it was completely optimized and designed for that. And as a result, you know, you have a system that scales from the largest data estates in the world to the smallest, you know, like one man and a dog and a handful of files. You can go on demand, you know, you don't have to spend any money. You get charged for what you actually consume. You don't need a contract, right? So you have this, it's, these things are new. We've never had that in the world of software, right? So, but I will tell you that in the early days of Snowflake starting to sell, data in the cloud for a lot of large enterprises was just like not a good idea. They were like afraid of it. You know, people are risk averse and they see nothing but downside. And the timing wasn't good. And we did mostly business with new enterprises, digital enterprises, people that were sort of born digital from the ground up. They never had a, you know, a traditional way of thinking about business. And, you know, to this day, some of those people are very large customers of ours now. I'm thinking about Instacart is a really large customer, DoorDash, right? These are all names that you know now know about, but they were absolutely, data was the beating heart from day one. And they understand data, they understand consumption models. And so they were very different from, say, Verizon or an AT&T or so on, people that have massive, you know, historical legacies that have to sort of be brought forward. And by the way, those enterprises are moving very fast now as well. But for them, it was not, they were not born digital. You know, they have to, you know, transition to digital. So, you know, for a time there, you know, we just had to wait for the market to catch up with us. I mean, I remember a conversation, you know, that we had with Goldman Sachs, and they said, this is great, but you need to be on the private cloud. And we're like, we think you'll be on the public cloud before we will ever be on the private cloud, which turned out to be true. But it's like we had to basically punt on doing business with them because we couldn't be on the private cloud, and that's what they wanted. Well, time changes things. Time changes everything.
It seems like a combination of time and just the power of the product and the versatility of the product and anticipating the changes that come with time.
Yeah. So here's the important thing. The world is a very dynamic place. It doesn't stay the same. It's constantly changing. So when you're building things, you need to be building things for where the puck is going to be, not where it is today. And that, by the way, is a huge problem. People have humans have a natural static way of viewing things. They're also very linear in their thinking. The world is not linear either. It's completely nonlinear. So that in other words, you have to have a real vision of the future as to how it's going to develop and then be right about that, obviously. Because a lot of people have visions of the future and they're wrong, you know, and then, you know, their reality just doesn't materialize. And then the ventures don't work. It's not like, you know, timing is off. It's like, no, your whole vision of the world is off, you know.
Makes sense. I want to jump back to something else you said, which was how you had to motivate your employees to push through the uncertainty that comes with the pandemic and just keep chugging and working on the company. How do you sell this vision and your vision of the future to Snowflake employees in particular?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm really selling it. Maybe I am. But employees know that we are going to do whatever it takes to succeed as an enterprise. And here's the contract, the unspoken contract that we have with employees. We are going to do absolutely everything, you know, to make the company successful. We're going to lift you. You're going to have the best career experience of your life. And, you know, we're going to lift your station in life to another level where you have levels of security and that, you know, you haven't had before, right? That's the deal. And that's also why, you know, I feel an enormous amount of pressure on the day-to-day basis because they count on me and we're counting on them, you know, at the same time. So, you know, employees want to join a cause. They want to join a mission. You know, it's not very inspiring to sign up for a paycheck and a cubicle and a logo. Okay, it's boring as hell. It's like being in the Matrix, right? And people want to join something that's going to make a dent in the universe. You know, they use another Steve Jobs expression, right? So we're going to give them the boldness, the mission, you know, the adventure, the career experience of a lifetime. You know, and if we are, you know, fortunate enough, you know, we're going to massively, you know, change your station in life. And obviously, we've done that now over the last 20 years in three different companies. And it's, I don't have to sell them on it. Okay. The types of people that, by the way, it helps having done this a few times because people naturally will follow because they're like, hell, you know where to, you know how to do this. So I've had people tell me, you know, I'll join your company, even if it's a bike shop, because they are just blindly trusting in, you know, in our ability to basically convert potential to outcome. That's very flattering, but hell, we still have to do it. You know, I take nothing for granted. So, you know, employees, you know, they're all at heart the same, not all of them, but most of them, you know, they want the same thing. You know, they want, you know, they want a great career experience. They want to advance their careers and they want to advance their families to a better, secure, more secure place. And that's what we are going to give them.
I think that's especially impactful for our audience, which is mostly students. And what you said was 100% true. Everyone is looking, especially at these early stages in their lives, for how to make the biggest dent they can and also be happy with the career path that they choose. So it's, I think it's reassuring to know that these opportunities are out there and that there are places where students can do both.
Well, they also need to know that, you know, I view it as my role, and I think a lot of CEOs feel that way, it's my role to enable their visions and their dreams and, you know, their ambitions, because I need to give them what they need out of it. Okay, that's the deal, right? It's not like, oh, we're just working for the investors here. It doesn't work that way at all. You know, and I'm not worried about investors, okay? Because if we do well, you know, they'll do fine also. So it's not hard.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this podcast, be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram @harvard_ventures. Tune in next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.